Curiosity. What are you so curious about?
Everything.
Mr. Curiosity.
Alrighty, folks. Joe Snedeker here. Mr. Curiosity with the latest and greatest podcast. And the beauty of the Mr. Curiosity podcast is, you know, sometimes they do people from WNEP. Everyone likes to know the details and gossip and life of the WNEP people. But then we go outside and we get recommendations from others. I've interviewed rock stars and owners of businesses. And now we got a guy, and I'll say a guy. See how I'm setting you up there, Rob? Called Rob O'Donnell, who was set up by my radio colleague, Nancy Kamen from WILK. Right, Rob?
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go through a couple things to grab people's interest. If you're saying, well, I don't want to listen to this. Yes, you do. Because Rob was born and raised in Queens, played drums for a few 80s icon bands before coming a police officer. I can't wait to hear about that. This one I'm a little confused by. Only first responder in America to be involved with 4 terror attacks on our homeland. So we'll find out about that. Married 28 years. All right. I have that badge too, brother. And your wife, personal trainer with Mindy Ramsey. What else could we say? Died once? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Law enforcement. Been on many talk shows and cable networks, national syndicated radio. How you doing, Rob?
Good. Glad to be here, Joe. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's start out with the accent. I already feel it. You're sick of people saying the New York accent. Do you hate that?
Yeah. You know, but, you know, it's part of who I am. You know, I've been here 19 years. I lived in Northeast Pennsylvania. So I'm almost here as long as I was there. So, you know, I lived in New York City 27 years. So I got a little more to go. But, you know, I think the 19 year mark, you know, I think I could consider myself a Pennsylvanian.
Oh, gosh. Yes. It's funny how, though, we hear around here, I guess we all, when you hear the New York accent, you immediately start judging whether it's conscious or not. You just start, oh, there's a New Yorker. Do you get a lot of that? Like, New Yorker, what are you doing here? New Yorker.
Yeah. I mean, the accent's picked up right away. You got it right away. You know, anybody you speak to has it right away. It's once you're out of this area, it's kind of, is that New York, Boston? Like when you're down south or something.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah,
that,
yeah.
They get it right away. But you know what's funny? When I looked for my house here, you know, almost 20 years ago, I made a circle of where the New Yorkers go to vacation, the Poconos, where they shop, where they travel.
Yeah.
And I moved. I bought a house outside of that ring because I didn't want to deal with the New Yorkers anymore.
Let me guess. That circle was like Long Pond. It was Poconos. It was the Paw Pack. Yeah. It was down towards Monroe, Carbon County, right?
Sure, but even lower Lackawanna County. You know, you got the Goldsboro area.
Moscow
area.
You have infiltrated that far west. So you said consciously, I want to go beyond that circle.
Yeah, so I'm within rocks throwing distance of the Susquehanna border. I live in northern Lackawanna County, just outside of that bubble where I figured, you know, I wanted the change as well.
I thought you would build a T-111 home at Big Bass Lake, like all the other New Yorkers. No,
no, not at all. Far from it.
All right, so what's it like in Queens? You know, a guy like me who, you know, left college for a few years to get out of the area, but married a girl from this area, born and raised in this area, have a job in this area, been a teacher in this area, a college professor in this area. To me, anything New York, Queens, Bronx, Manhattan, Long Island, it just seems intimidating. Big people. Crime, energy, opportunity, but a lot of negatives too. Like, what's your take on the whole Queens upbringing?
You know, I wouldn't, when I look back at it, I wouldn't change it for anything in the world because I've traveled throughout the world. You know, I got bored with the typical spring breaks when I was in college and even beyond when I was a rookie police officer, you know, going to Fort Lauderdale, going to the Bahamas, going to Cancun, Mexico.
You did all that?
Yeah, so I started traveling to South America. So my spring breaks consisted of me going to, you know, Bogota, Colombia, you know, Caracas, Venezuela, and stuff like that. And just growing up, have that situational awareness of being born and raised in New York City, where it just back in the 70s and 80s was not a safe place. You have that situational awareness where I could travel anywhere in the world and feel comfortable and not feel like there's a threat around the corner because I'm just used to always looking around the corner. And my kids and wife and people that I would go traveling with now, you know, just walking down the street, you know, my wife and I went to New Orleans a couple months ago. And as we were walking, I was pointing out people saying, "Oh, see what these people are doing? They're looking to pickpocket someone. See what this person
is that
doing?"
Right? So you have this keen sense of awareness, this hyper vigilance.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you
That's interesting. And,
now, I am very thankful for that upbringing. And I see my kids, they're all grown now. My youngest is just turned 20. My oldest is 27. And, you know, when they go to places like New York now, or they travel to New Orleans or somewhere themselves, you know, I know growing up in rural Pennsylvania, they really don't have that because, you know, I moved here for the rest of my life to raise my family and grow old. I don't want to look over my shoulder anymore. I don't want to look around the corner or ahead of me to see what's going on. And this
and do
is really
you? You
a great
don't.
Place for
and,
that.
Yeah, it is. I'm already judging you, though. When you said that when you were in college, you went to South America, I believe you said. My parents and my family didn't even have the money for me to get out of Lackawanna County. I'm guessing, I'm supposing that you come from some cash. Maybe the dad had a good job, mom, something like that. How do you vacation all around the world when you're in college?
Quite the opposite, Joe. I have two brothers. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. My dad worked 2 and 3 jobs, you know, barely making ends meet. But they thought growing up in New York City with 3 sons, you know, it was better for a mom to be home and have a watchful eye on them. She was without a doubt the disciplinarian of our family. So, you know, it was struggling times back then. You know, if you got hurt or need to go to the hospital, it was, well, how bad is it really? Because the hospital bills are hospital bills. And, you know, it really was not. And my parents ended up leaving to Boston because my father did get a better job, you know, as time went on. When I was, I think I just turned 21. And they moved and I took over the townhouse that we were living in, the apartment we were living in.
Right.
And continued living there, you know, as an adult where I grew up. But my motto was always work hard, play hard. So I worked when I was going to college. I was going to college full time. I worked 2 and 3 jobs and, you know, saved my money because when I went on vacation, I didn't want money to be an obstacle for those week or two that I was on vacation. So that was my motto back then.
I take my judgment call back then. But I would seriously vacation in Lackawanna County when I was in college, and some of my friends would go to like Cancun and the bikini girls in Miami and Fort Lauderdale, and I was stuck here. So I'm glad you did that. So in high school, though, I'm trying to picture a high school in Queens, and of course you can't simplify something that broad, but what was it like?
It's actually real easy to picture. If you ever see the movie A Bronx Tale, the high school
I did, yeah.
The high school they use in that movie where the young kid and meets his girlfriend, that's my high school, William Cullen Bryan High School in Woodside, Queens. So
wow.
That was filmed in my high school. But, you know, you look at the high schools here, you know, I think our total population of a high school here is like 400 for the entire 4 grades.
Yeah, most graduating classes, 100, 150, something like that.
Yeah, I think my high school, it was like 2,200. Kids for the 4 grades. Yeah.
All ethnic diversity, all different types, right? And you're just you're just a name, you're a number, right? You're not, you don't even know some of your classmates, right?
You knew your friends and that's pretty much it. You kind of knew everybody by sight, you know, knew the groups by sight, but you only knew your core group of friends and maybe a few others outside of that because it was so big.
So it wasn't like Welcome Back, Cotter?
No, not at all.
See, that's in my mind forever. Like anyone from New York, Welcome Back, Cotter.
Yeah.
A lot of old dingy buildings, a lot of poverty. That's my mental image. It's sad, but it's true.
You know, back in the 70s and 80s, that was the case.
I tell people that, you know, because now what they did to downtown New York, it's where the place people want to go now, right? When you picture...
Well, not now. It was for the later part of the 90s and early 2000s.
Pre-COVID,
It's starting to get back there now. It's starting to, you know, they're starting to let it slide to where, you know, they're seeing touches of that late 80s, early 90s again.
You're right. But remember all those movies from the 60s and 70s? It was just all crime and dark alleys and poverty.
It wasn't just that. When I first became a police officer in 1991, my first assignment was Times Square, where you had all the pornographic theater, the X-rated theaters. You know, you couldn't walk 5 steps without someone raped, shot, or stabbed, or robbed. It was bad, but you know, you learn the job very quickly by walking a street like
that.
So
when was that, Rob? What year was that? What year did you become a police officer? So you get out of high school and what happens?
I started working, my goal in college was music therapy. You know, I was a musician all through, you know, my youth, and I decided to go into a field that way. I worked for the Office of Mental Health as a crisis preventionist with, emotional support students. Being a crisis preventionist, when they got too violent for the public schools, they put them in these campuses that were also residential homes.
Okay.
So they couldn't harm themselves or others. So I was a crisis preventionist where you learn to talk to them down from having, you know, an explosion in class and, you know, being certified by the state to restrain them.
So what was the major in college? Was like social work?
It was music therapy.
Music therapy. Get out of here. And you seem like this big, tough, burly guy. You would never go into music therapy.
Well, I was a musician, and I was a lot thinner in my youth. You kind of fill into the age you are, I guess.
I'm not implying that you're overweight. You just look like a tough guy. You just look like a bouncer at a bar.
That was one of the three jobs I had in college. So
you get into music therapy. You're a musician. You're playing drums. You're a 20 something. You get when you get into the police force, and tell me about these 80s bands. I got to hear that.
Yeah, like in 1991, I was called for the police department. You know, it was something I always wanted to do. I guess the job I was doing then, working, you know, in the capacity with the Office of Mental Health, dealing with these children who have both severe psychological issues and behavioral issues, you know, it was just a wider scale to help on that platform. But when I got called for the police department in 1991, you know, being Irish in New York, you know, there was a couple of things you did, you know, fireman, police officer, you know, criminal or continue with the profession you're at. So I just saw it as a larger calling and ended up leaving college in just after my second year and going to the police academy. But before that,
I thought you need like a criminology degree or something. Maybe back then you can just slip into the police work. How does that happen?
Yeah, back then it was a high school diploma. You actually get, I think it's a semester's worth of college credits for going to the police academy because you're taking sociology, psychology, and of course, physical education and a bunch of other things. So I think you end up coming out of the police academy with like 18 or 19 credits as well.
So you're a police officer stationed where in the city in the early 90s? I can't even picture this. Is it like the movies?
Yeah, Midtown Manhattan was it.
Get out of here.
And rookie police officers normally work the 8 at night to 4 in the morning shift. So I was out there for the depth of it, you know, in the middle of the night, Midtown Manhattan.
I mean, when I picture it, for whatever reason, it's appealing. If there's a movie about police officers and crime in New York City, I have to watch it. I mean, is it what we think, what we've been fed by the, by pop culture?
Some of it is, Blue Bloods TV show that's out there is very close to everything doesn't get solved. Everything doesn't get solved in 45 minutes with commercials and, you know, the way they exaggerate things. But, you know, NYPD Blue was close. Law and Order kind of pushes the envelope a little bit, you know, with dramatics. But there are shows out there that get close.
My feeling is when you're a police officer in New York City, you're so saturated with negativity and crime. It seems like half the time you're turning your heads and looking for a bigger crime. Is there any truth to that? I mean, you're overlooking bums on the streets, unfortunately, and prostitutes and drug dealers. And it's just so commonplace. It becomes second nature, correct?
Yeah. I mean, back then, the larger crimes were there right in front of you. You know, the city was kind of scourged by the crack epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s. And crime was rampant. And, you know, we were enforcing the broken windows theory where the smaller crimes, people who commit the bigger crimes also commit the smaller crimes. So, you know, if you target the smaller crimes, you prevent the bigger crimes and you end up getting people for warrants for the bigger crimes. So, you know, even if you're getting someone just jumping the turnstile, you know, if you're going to rob someone or you just committed a bank robbery upstairs, you're not going to pay your $1.50, whatever it was back then, to get on the subway. You're going to jump the turnstile. So you arrest somebody for a simple offense like jumping the turnstile and you find out they have a gun because they planned on robbing people or they just robbed the bank upstairs. You know, we had that more than one occasion, especially in Midtown Manhattan, where someone would rob the bank. Where's the first place they go? They run into the subway system.
And you're so chasing, you're doing that. You're chasing bank robbers and arresting prostitutes and drug. You're doing all that.
Yeah, it depends what your focus was as a general patrol officer out on the street in uniform walking and beat, you know, whatever came your way. You know, if you were the arresting officer, you were the arresting officer. My first arrest was a robbery of a commercial truck where they were robbing the guy in the back of the truck. And I came walking around the corner and the guy looked at me. The victim saw me in uniform and said, "Help, they're robbing me." And the guys turned around and were like, "I'm sorry."
Get out of here.
You know, put him in handcuffs. And I think I was only out for a couple of weeks and, you know, called my supervisor and said, I think I have a robbery. You know, they came back and they were like, "Hey, great job, kid."
But when you think about the movies like 48 Hours, and are you shooting at people? Are you getting shot at? Or is that a very rare occurrence? You know, I mean, when you think about some of these pop culture movies that are entrenched in our brain.
Yeah, it's rare. I mean, you take I've had my gun out, you know, a lot of times. I've really only come close to shooting someone once, where it was actually, you know, squeezing the trigger, and then the situation changed where I didn't have to. Thankfully, you know, I've been in a couple situations where we've been shot at. So, you know, it happens, but it's not like an everyday occurrence like you see in these shows that try and keep the audience captive.
Yeah. And when you were doing that, were you thinking, "I can't do this the rest of my life," or were you hunkered in like, "This is it. This is it. This is 20, 25 years.
It was a great job. You know, I miss the work I did. I don't miss the politics of it. I don't miss where it's gone lately as far as, you know, just targeting law enforcement as a bad entity. I'm glad I'm out. I miss that the day-to-day work that we did, because we really did, and they still do, excellent work. You look back and you kind of miss it.
I don't want to get political in any way, but the whole defund the police thing fried my ham so much. Like, in any profession, you're going to find a couple bad eggs, as they say, but come on, defund the police is just ridiculous. And to have you guys get a bad reputation is, you know, when you're fighting the good fight and keeping the laws intact, how dare that evolve out of nothingness?
Yeah. I mean, when you look at policing as a totality, I mean, there's 800,000 law enforcement officers in America. They have 30 million contacts with the public. When you look at the incidents that do happen, and I'll be the first to admit, policing is not a perfect profession. It never will be a perfect profession.
But nothing is.
But show me a perfect profession. And I'd love to study that. And I'm sure every police department in the country would love to study them. But I'll put law enforcement up against any other profession any day of the week. When you look at the amount of contacts we have with the public and how often these bad incidents do happen, you are more likely to be struck by lightning. And I've actually run the actual statistics. You are more likely to be struck by lightning in America than you are to be unarmed and shot by the police.
Wow, I love it. That's a great stat if it's accurate, but it seems like it should be, right, based on the numbers. And I know my lightning numbers too. And it depends on where you are too. You have a better chance in Florida to be struck by lightning. These things I know. So are you playing drums at the time when you're a police officer? And what are your music interests at the time in the 80s?
Well, 90s. Right out of in the academy, I was approached by the New York City Police Emerald Society Pipes and Drums to join. Okay. Because somebody knew someone and knew I played, and they were looking for membership. And it wasn't like they had to teach me how to play. It was like, okay, here's your uniform. You're marching with us that day. So they approached me. I said, "Well, at least let me get out of the police academy, because, you know, being a rookie police officer still in the police academy, you know, you don't want to put that kind of target on your back that you're getting special treatment or you're doing anything like that." But right after graduation, I joined and marched in the Fifth Avenue St. Patrick's Day parade that year. And, you know, I played with the pipes and drums all the way up until I was injured and really couldn't carry a drum and play anymore.
So, is that right? That's awesome.
So it was great. I mean, being Irish American with a last name like O'Donnell, you know, graduating, here I am, a police officer marching down and leading the police department in the St. Patrick's Day parade. It was a great feeling at first. After a couple of years, when it's snowing and icing on us, and you have 2 inches of snow on your drum, you know, it was like, all right, maybe enough of this. But it was great to represent both my heritage and the police department in that fact.
That is pretty cool. So are you a prolific drummer even now?
I still have my drums. You know, they're still here. My father was a drummer. My son actually played drums in school. We're talking about maybe him taking the drum set here just so we can get more space in our basement now. But, you know, every once in a while, it's good to put the headset on and go down and still play.
You didn't play like backup to backup for Def Leppard or anything like that? The one armed drummer?
No, no. But to get back to that first question, like the 80s icon, it was funny. I my middle school principal was the uncle of Debbie Gibson. And after her first tour and her first hit album, they ended up their drummer, I guess, on tour got a little crazy and they ended up firing him and they needed a drummer. So he reached out to me knowing back in middle school and junior high school, I was a good drummer then. And I think I was only 19 at the time. And he says, hey, you know, I want to bring you out to the studio and have you, you know, sit in with Debbie Gibson for her next tour. So, you know, I show up in a unnamed studio out in Long Island, New York, and bring in my drums. And lo and behold, here's Debra Gibson and her entire band, you know, minus a drummer. And, you know, they give you a week. Here's our CD. Learn the songs. And you learn the songs. And, you know, I ended up playing with them and sat down and we're in discussions with them. But it's in hindsight.
Was she a nice person? Nice person?
She was great. I mean, she was, I think she's only a year younger than me. So, you know, at that time, if I was 19, she was 18. You know, she was still a kid. You know, I was just
I believe
19,
she started so out like at the malls, right? She went from mall singer to pop star.
Yeah, to Madison Square Garden. And the tour was on Madison Square Garden. So I ended up sitting in with them and doing some studio work. But thankfully, you know, chose not to go on tour because it probably would have taken my life in a totally different direction.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. What was her song? Why can't I think of it? I think, I mean, Debbie Gibson, help me out. We don't, you don't know? What was
there was Foolish Beat was her biggest, one of her biggest hits.
Doesn't ring a bell.
But yeah, it wasn't my kind of music. I was more
I was listening to Todd Rundgren at the time, but whatever.
Yeah. But then after I was... after that, on one of my spring breaks in the Bahamas, actually, I'm down there and there's a huge club in Nassau, Bahamas, right off of Paradise Island called Club Waterloo. Still there today. And it was just huge. It had four or five stages. It had a live band, one or two live bands, a DJ, an outdoor and indoor. It was just a real nice place.
Right.
And I ended up sitting in with the band. They were a band called High Voltage. And I ended up sitting in with them. And
named after AC/DC's album, I bet.
You know, they were more of a Bahamas cover band, top 40 stuff.
Right.
But, you know, it wasn't rock and roll at all. It was all top 40s, dance music, you know, pop, rock and roll and stuff like that. So, you know, I ended up sitting in with them, playing a couple songs. And then they asked me to come up on stage as like the next couple of days I was there. They see me in the crowd and say, hey, come on up and play a couple songs, basically just to give their drummer a break. You know, we played and I went back the following year. And they changed their names to High Voltage to the Bohemians. Same type of music. They were still doing, you know, top 40 cover. And when I was down there, they saw me, you know, the next year, recognized me and said, hey, come on up. Their drummer ended up breaking their hand.
Okay.
When I was there. And the next thing I know, they're knocking on my hotel door and they're like, hey, can you come on over and play with us? You know, the drummer's name was Mo, you know, broke his hand and we need a drummer because he really can't play. So I ended up sitting in with them for the week I was there and ended up staying. You know, I called home and said, I don't think I'm coming home. I'm going to stay in the Bahamas for a little bit. But, you know, they wanted to set me up with a couple offshoots for their bands in the Bahamas. And I was, you can only stay up late at night, wake up early and drink the rest of the day so many days when you're 20.
Oh, so, dude, you know, that's a lifestyle. Yeah, that's a lifestyle.
Yeah, well, it is when you look at it from the outside and say, oh, that would be great. But when you're living it, it's like after about a month, it's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to die.
Oh,
so
when you're at that age,
ended up coming
caught
home
up in the whirlwind and you don't even realize it. You're just going with it.
But I end up coming home. You know, I become a police officer. I meet my wife and it was when the Mets were in the World Series and they're having the opening act before the World Series starts. And it was the Baja Men, Who Let the Dogs Out, the famous song, Who Let the Dogs Out. Well, the Baja Men were the Bohemians, were High Voltage that I was playing with down in the Bahamas.
They went from High Voltage to Bohemians to Baja Men?
Yep.
Oh, man. And I mean, that song is so bad, it's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they really was on One Hit Wonder. They had an album or two after that. But just I'm sitting on a couch with my wife, and I'm like, hey, I know them.
Yeah. So for the rest of your life, who let the dogs out? You can say, I know those guys. I played with those guys.
That could have been me.
The Baja, man. So when you were in your 20s and you were a police officer and doing some of these drumming gigs, were you still living at home? with the parents?
No, my parents left before I became a police officer. Oh. Just before.
So you have your own apartment in the city. You're working the overnight shift. You're getting shot at. You're drumming. I mean, this is a lot for a 20-something guy.
Yeah, it was a fun life. I could look back and at this stage in my life, I look back and say, you know, I wouldn't change much, you know, if I had the opportunity to, because I really lived a full life and did a lot of things, you know, that I'm happy with. So
how long were you doing that in the city, police officer?
I retired in the end of 2003. I was kind of banged up during 9/11.
Whoa! And, so how many years is that? That's 20-year career there?
No. I got out before that because of my injuries. I had to retire from the injuries I received. They ended up putting steel rods in my neck. So you can't go chasing bad guys and climbing fences and possibly get into a vehicle accident chasing someone when you have that kind of surgery. So I was forced to retire, but you know, at that point I was in the homicide task force and I had a lot of the DNA cases from 9/11. And I wouldn't retire till all my notifications were done and all my identifications, you know, for the families were made, because every detective, you know, had 100-something cases for their area wherever they were working to make the identification and notifications to the families.
Well, I'm confused. So maybe you had 10 years in, but I'm still the whole police officer thing. And it's easy to offend you guys with the titles. There's police officer, there's officer, there's lieutenant, there's detective, there's sheriff, there's help me out here. There's all these terms for you guys, and we just say cops. Like, what were you, and how did you elevate yourself through the ranks, so to speak?
Yeah, I was promoted twice. You start off in New York City as a police officer.
So police officer is the correct term. That's the lowly guy on the streets in the car arresting. You know, and he's like the grunt, so to speak.
Yeah. Yep. And then from there, you know, based on some good work out of the 30,000 people that we had there, I was recognized by the police commissioner and I was promoted to police officer special assignment.
Special assignment.
You're still a police officer. It's a pay raise and, you know, the recognition that you've done excellent work as a police officer. So, you know, out of the 35,000 people, I think only 1,000 were elevated to police officer special assignment.
Oh.
And that's kind of the path where you're being recognized as a really good police officer. So it was an honor to have that. And I had that for a while. And then from there, I went into the investigative. There's two avenues you can go as a police officer. You can go the investigative route, which brings you to detective sergeant, you know, squad commander, which is a lieutenant or captain. Or you could take tests and get promoted from police officer to sergeant to lieutenant to captain to deputy inspector, chief. And then so on from there.
So you're rising up through. Is that how it works then? Most police officers don't think this is it for the rest of my life. I'm going to start working up through the ranks, right?
More or less. Some people just love the street work and that's all they want to do. Taking the test and becoming a boss and a supervisor of other people didn't really interest me. I wanted to get promoted through the investigative ranks. So, you know, that's where I went into the investigative path. You have to work there for 2 years. And then after that, if you have the evaluations and the record to do it, you get promoted to detective. And from there, they have their own promotion. You can get detective first grade, detective second grade. Let me get back a little bit. When you're made a detective, it's a detective third grade. That's the lowest rank of detective. And then it's detective second grade, detective first grade that goes up those ranks. And at any time, you could take the promotion test to become sergeant. But you know, I like the work of being an investigator. So that's the route I went.
Here's my impression. There's a dead body on the ground. They have the chalk outline. There's 5 police cars. The lights are going. And here comes the detective. He's got his regular guy clothes on, maybe a suit. He's got a little notepad. He flips it. He comes onto the scene. Everyone parts their ways. And he's like a big shot telling everyone what to do. Is that accurate?
Well, not the big shot telling. It's your crime scene. You're in charge of it. It's your investigation. But you have the same rank as a police officer. So it's not like you're ordering people around.
Okay.
You're asking people to do things. It is your crime scene. You're in charge, but it's not like you're barking orders at people. You know, a sergeant is still my supervisor and a lieutenant is still my supervisor, but they kind of let you take control of it because it's your thing, not their thing. They're there to guard the crime scene and protect it. You're there to investigate it.
So you must understand, though, a lot of regular guys like me, all we know of what you do is what we see in the movies. There's no other angle on your life other than the movies, because how else would we know? So do you get mad when you see this on TV and your movies? You're like, no, it's not like that. Stop.
No, it's like anything. I mean, it's like any profession. You know, what you see on TV, I'm sure these medical shows on TV, these doctor shows, you know, same thing. The medical professions are looking at it going, that's not how this works.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I was on the radio with Nancy last week, the producer said, hey, do you go home? Do you watch real live TV or police TV, or do you watch these police shows? And I said, you know, well, do you go home and watch WKRP in Cincinnati? it's not something that interests me. I lived it. I've done it. I'm not going to sit and watch it at home on my spare time.
A great show, by the way. Who's your favorite character on that? Johnny Fever?
Yeah.
Yeah, he man, if you grew
Les Nessman. I mean, you can't you can't put aside Les Nessman.
And we all need bosses like the GM of the place, right? He was just a
good. That was just a perfect cast. That was the Office of yesterday. It was just the perfect cast of characters that they put together from all different backgrounds. You know, Lonnie Anderson's the secretary. You had the boss. You had the program director cowboy. You know, you had the soul and blues DJ. You had the rock and roll DJ. You had Les Nessman.
If you were a teenager in the 70s and 80s, man, you had it made with shows like that. As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
Classic.
That doesn't get any better. So what happens to you to allow, or at least proceed into this being taken from the business? You said you had some injuries, or you had some, how did that happen? Was it just a part of the ongoing process of living, or were there an incident?
No, just getting banged around. I was there the day of 9/11, you know, moving stuff, trying to sift through stuff. I was there. I worked the scene for a year after, you know, during the recovery process. But I was there from that day working for a year, and just the getting banged around that day, you know, running for our lives, hiding under things, getting knocked around.
Could you tell me a little bit about that? So it was this clear blue sky day, right? You were, I'm trying to do the math here, 30 something, right? At the time?
31.
So you're 31, out of nowhere, the attacks occur. And what, were you on patrol at the time, or you woke up the next day and they said, how did you get onto that environment?
Well, I was a homicide detective at that point, and we just made a homicide arrest 3 days before 9/11 and worked the case. And we actually made the arrest the day before on September 10th. You know, we found the body on like the 7th or 8th of September. It took us a couple days to find out who was our suspect, and we ended up arresting them on the 10th, processing them. And when all was said and done, I think it was like 2 o'clock in the morning on September 11th that I finally brought them downtown and lodged them. And that's like you see on TV, you bring them downtown and you put them in the big building.
Is that right?
The jail cells. Yeah. Cause the NYPD, you know, uses the same building that they've used in the 40s, you know, to house prisoners.
Get out of here. So it is. That's interesting. Yeah. The gates slam, the bars locked.
Yeah. And it's right across from the courthouse. So they'll go to court the next morning.
Were you still doing overnights then, or no? No.
No. I was working when you catch a homicide, when you catch a murder, basically you work until all leads are exhausted. It could be 2 days. It could be a week. You know, you're going to sleep in the bunk room for an hour or two, but you're going to chase down leads until you catch somebody. Or it goes so cold that there's really nothing else to chase. That's one of the great things. You know, that's where the show 48 Hours comes from. You know, you'll work that 48 hours straight.
Oh, I
regardless.
See.
You don't go, there is no, my shift ends now, I'm going home. If you're the detective crew that catches that murder, you're working in different directions. You're following different leads. You're going in different directions until all the leads are exhausted, or you get on a lead and catch somebody and bring them in. And at that point, you know, now you have Miranda rights, questioning, video, you know, confessions, writing statements down, doing the paperwork and all that. So, you know, you could be working anywhere from a couple hours to a couple of days to a couple of weeks, you know, straight.
So it's like you're on call 24/7.
Yep. So we just finished, and I told my boss, I was supposed to be in at 7 o'clock the next morning. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, hey, we've been working this case for the past couple of days. You know, I'll get in tomorrow when I get in. And it was like, oh, no problem. It's understood. You guys were working hard for a couple of days. You know, if you come in late tomorrow, it's not a big deal.
Right.
So, I was home just getting ready to go in because I think I was planning to get into work at like 9 anyway. And I saw the first plane hit the tower and on TV while I was getting ready. I was just out of the shower.
And where are you at this moment? Where are you? How far away from them is your apartment?
In Long Island.
Wow. West Coast, West Side. So you're near the city.
Yeah. So
Western side of Long Island.
You know, at that point, the newscasters were like, thought it was a small private plane. It was an accident. We don't know what really hit it. And then live on TV, we saw the second plane fly in and you could see right away that was an airline carrier, commercial airplane. So, at that point, it's grab everything, grab my red light in the car and get it up on the car and start heading in. My brother worked at the World Trade Centers in Building 5. So, as this was going on, we couldn't get in touch with him. Of course, cell phones in Manhattan were down. Cell phones were having trouble everywhere. I called work and I said, hey, I'm going to go straight to the scene at the World Trade Center. My brother works down there. We can't get in touch with him. Thankfully, he was in another building when this happened, and he was up in Midtown at a meeting still. Wow. And wasn't in this facility. But we didn't know that because we didn't have any contact.
Right.
So, just as I'm getting into Queens, you could see the smoke pillars in there from a distance. Tower One comes down. And at that point, I was about 10 minutes from the Brooklyn Bridge, made it to the Brooklyn Bridge, abandoned the vehicle on the side of the road there and ended up on the Manhattan side of the Brooklyn Bridge. We got in, and because I worked Midtown Manhattan as a rookie cop years earlier, I knew the World Trade Center, the subterranean of the World Trade Center, which is about 14 stories, is if you know it well, you can navigate in there. And since the first building came down already, it was, how do we find ways to get inside the building from underneath to see if there's survivors, see who's there, knowing that Building 2 would come down, eventually. And at that time, Tower 2 came down, and it was basically, flee and shelter for your life, at that point.
So I'm sure you might get emotional if you keep going on with this, but what was the scene? Just total chaos, debris, clouds of dust, smoke everywhere. You can't even tell what's going on. Is it like that much random chaos?
Well, coming in from the outside in while it was happening, an engine from one of the jetliners was like 5 blocks away on the side of the street.
And is that
there
right?
Uniformed cops there. The gruesome scenes, one of the things that I passed, was the torso of one of the flight attendants.
No.
And you could tell because the uniform was still there strapped into her jump seat. And, you just make sure, hey, there's cops, just guard this, make sure no one goes near it. This is evidence. It's part of the crime scene. But then you get in and then you notice the one of the biggest things I noticed was my eyes burning because there was just pulverized glass in the smoke. So your eyes immediately felt like they were scratched. Your corneas were all scratched and bad. And then, of course, the air got worse and worse. And we had to kind of take shelter until the dust settled and such like that. But at that point, we weren't getting much information. We heard there were 8 or 9 aircraft still out there. And, later after the two towers came down, we finally got air cover from our military. But we didn't know if that was another strike coming in. So you're diving for cover thinking this is it. And, I know I sent you one of the stories of they did on me and my son. My son was 6 at the time. My wife was 7 months pregnant. And I was able to make contact with them later that day and just tell them, hey, I don't think I'm coming home. You're going to have to take care of your mother and the new baby. And, to have that conversation with your 6-year-old son.
Yeah.
It creates a bond that you as a father yourself, you can only imagine, that special bond that we have because of that. And then even my daughters, my daughter knows that it was my middle daughter, she might have not been born with a father, if it went bad, bad the other way. And my youngest daughter, to this day, she's followed her brother's footstep and is attending the Naval Academy, said, I wouldn't even be here if something happened to you on 9/11. I wouldn't even exist. So, her gift of service is because she says her life is a gift. So
when this is all taking place on 9/11 in the mid-morning, you're spending the entire day there. You have no hopes of going home that evening because the city was in chaos. How long were you there and what were you doing, say 5, 10, 15 hours later?
Well, most of the stuff at that point was just evacuating as many people as we can from lower Manhattan. We were throwing, telling people, directing them over the bridges.
Oh, okay.
At one point, we were throwing people on every boat that came You know, I know that they did a big special on the great boat lift on 9/11, where these ferries and just personal boats would pull up to the docks, and we were just throwing as many people on as we could to get them to evacuate lower Manhattan and eventually, you know, the entire island of Manhattan.
So you spent how long there that day where you didn't come home? You said you were just
It was like 40 hours or so.
Some
supervisor finally grabbed me, you know, not just me, a bunch of us, and said, "Hey, how long have you guys been here?
Yeah,
you know, since it started." And it was like, "All right, you need to go home." And so, you know, we went back, drove home, changed on my back deck, took all my clothes off because they were caked in gut. You know, I hosed off. We'd go in, took a shower again, and laid in bed and stared at the ceiling for 2 hours and said, "You know, I need to go back. There's no use of me being here. I'm not going to sleep. I'm not going to rest. I need to go back. My friends are missing."
How do you do anything in that circumstance? And now, decades later, I know the instances of respiratory illness and cancers are on the increase. Some of your friends, you yourself, have you been tested? Is everything okay? Do you know of individuals caught in that health circumstance?
Yeah, I mean, guys I worked with side by side for the year after, sifting through the rubble and identifying pieces of bone, pieces of hair, you know, personal property, you know, they're dying daily today. I mean, 9/11 is taking just as many people after that day than it did that day, as far as health concerns. You know, my health concerns, you know, I have them. I have the lung capacity of an 80-year-old who smoked his entire life. You know,
because of that.
I never smoked a day in my life. You know, you have the issues and it's just the scariness of it now. When you have a pain in your side, okay, is this the big one? You know, is this something wrong now? Because they're finding cancers, they're finding, you know,
right,
tumors, respiratory illnesses. You know, anytime I have a smark on my skin, you know, that needs to be tested, it needs to be scraped off. And it's just you get a regular flu. Okay, well, is this more than the flu? It's just that cloud over you that affects not just me, affects anyone who was there and exposed to it, you know, that you live with day in and day out.
Well, Rob, I know you don't want to hear this, but you are a hero because there could have been cowards that said, "I got to get out of here," and just left as fast as they could. But instead of leaving, you go in, right? I mean, that's a decision you make on the spot.
Yeah, I have a very good friend now. She was actually a personal trainer. She had her master's degree in physiology. She was a personal trainer at a gym for Morgan Stanley, I believe, and was there that day. And she was in her 30s. Like I said, she had her master's degree.
Okay.
And as she was running out, for the past decade now, we've been very close. You know, she saw the police and the firemen running in. She ended up quitting her job and becoming a police officer at the age of 30. And she's now the highest ranking female in the city of Secaucus, New Jersey, because, you know, 9/11 was so dramatic on her, seeing the people rush past her into the building.
Right.
She changed her entire life, her entire career, and said, "This is what I want to do." And that kind of highlights what you were just saying, you know, this and highlights the relationship that we have that's so close now, that, you know, that's how we see each. I see her as a hero for quitting her job and taking up this line of work, you know, and she looks at me and says, "Well, you were the ones running into the building that made me change my life." So
many people changed and inspired from the stories like that. So is it safe to say for you, if 9/11 didn't happen, we wouldn't be having this conversation? Because when you leave in 2004, was it like the byproduct of that situation in a way? Like, I got to get out of here. I need a new life. I need a change.
Well, no? One of the things working as a police officer in New York City is you have a residency requirement. You have to live in the city or the surrounding boroughs. So I didn't have, once I retired, I did not have that anymore. I wanted to get out of the area. I wanted to,
even before 9/11.
No, when I retired. So, you know, 9/11 happened. I worked. I didn't have my surgery till about Thanksgiving 2003. I had my daughters. My daughters are 11 months apart. I had them back to back in 2002. And how I realized that I started to were having issues is I had one-year-old and I had one brand newborn in a car seat. And I wasn't able to carry them. I was losing all function in my left side. So, you know, went to the doctor, started getting things done. They said, "Yeah, you have fractures and compression in your C-spine. You're going to be paralyzed if we don't go in and fix it." You know, so in the end of, I lived with the pain during 9/11. You knew you were hurt. You knew during the recovery that things weren't right, but there was no such thing as, hey, I'm hurt, I need to go home. You went in and did your job because, you know, that's what we do. And, you know, I had the surgery finally because I realized that, you know, I can't lose function in my left side. Had the surgery in the end of 2003, and was retired right after that. Cause like I said, you can't have that kind of surgery and still, you know, take the risk of chasing people over fences, you know, getting into a vehicle crash. So I retired on December 31st of 2003, found my house here in Northeast Pennsylvania on January 3rd of 2004. So I think it was three days later, I found this house. It was the second house we looked at. It's, I mean, you know, the area well, it's on top of, Bell Mountain. I can see the steam coming from the Berwick smokestacks from my back deck.
Yeah.
And we looked at the view, we looked at the house and said, yeah, this is where I want to spend the rest of my life and raise my children.
But back up. So if I took you in your brain back to 1998, 1999, 2000, and someone said, oh, in 5-6 years, you're going to be living in rural northeastern PA. Would you have believed that, or were the makings of that already happening? Did you know I can't spend the rest of my life here? Or is it?
No, I would have done 7 more years with the police department. I think okay. I retired with 13 years on. So I would have been there for at least another 7 years. You know, who knows where my career would have been at that point, you know, say another 5 years, or if it's something that's really looking at, who moved, you know, I could have moved to Florida like all the other snowbirds do, retire and move to Florida. you know, Savannah, Georgia. Actually, the two places that we wanted to move was either Northeast Pennsylvania here or Savannah, Georgia area. My wife wanted to stay closer to New York because, you know, you talk about me being from Queens with an accent. My wife's from Brooklyn.
Oh, all right.
With an accent even worse than mine. So.
But that day in 2002 or 3 or early 4, I don't know, when you, I'm trying to create a dramatic situation here. You open up a map or you're on Google. What makes you search Northeastern PA? Like what made you target even Lackawanna County? You know, what is it? Did you have a relative, friend, something?
Yeah. My parents lived in Moscow, Pennsylvania.
Oh,
down there. Ooh. And, I ended up losing my father at the age of 59 to colon cancer. And he died an hour and 15 minutes into September 12th of the 1 year anniversary of 9/11. So I spent the 1 year anniversary of 9/11 in a hospice in Scranton with my dad. And, I finally, you know, it's the 1 year anniversary. I cannot give kudos to the hospice staff in Scranton enough, because I was a mess. It was the 1 year anniversary. They were playing everything on TV. I'm there with my father who's dying in front of me. And, you know, they were great. I think they took care of me more than they did a lot of the other patients that were there, unfortunately. But they were great. And I think I just dozed off and it was like an hour and 15 minutes into 9/12. He held in and didn't die on the 1 year anniversary. And they woke me up and said, you know, he's gone. So my mom was here, you know, at a young age. I said my dad passed away at 59. This was 2002. I had the 3 children at that point. My mom was here by herself. So I said, you know, let's look to get somewhere closer to her so she can, you know, have the grandkids around to kind of preoccupy her, you know, after she's newly been alone too. So it was kind of a no-brainer there, but I still moved out of that bubble where the New Yorkers go.
Dude, you've been through a lot though. The stories continue. So since 2004, you settle in. I'm assuming you're not at the point in life in 2004, 5 where you're like, okay, I'm set for life now. I'm 40 some years old, 30 some years old at the time. Like, you know, what were you thinking? I need a new career. I need a new job. What do you do next?
Well, it's kind of just reevaluate everything at that point. You know, I moved here. I think we finally moved in the middle of April. So it was springtime. And, you know, meeting the neighbors. I live in a real rural area. It's a dirt road with not many neighbors.
All right.
But like you said, I'm 30 something. You know, you'd sit on the front porch with your coffee in the morning and wave to the neighbors as they go to work in the morning. And they're coming back in the afternoon and you're sitting out there with an iced tea, drinking the same coffee. And their waves slowly turned into giving me the finger, because here's these 50 and 60 year old contractors and farmers, you know, saying, who the hell's this guy think he is? And then my wife's
New York career drinking his iced tea.
My wife would come out and say, you know, what are you going to do today? I said, oh, I'm going to watch that squirrel over there. I think he's going to go for that tree, but I'll let you know.
Yeah, but you say that in jest. Honestly, your brain had to be in chaos. You had to be thinking, I can't just do nothing the rest of my life.
That's just not who I am.
Even if you're a parent and you're busy with that, some people find meaning in their work. One of my buddies always says, the only thing worse than working is not working. And there's truth in that. No one likes
there
to
is.
Work, but yet it's our purpose in life in many ways.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
And I ended up becoming the director of public safety for a community out here in Northeast Pennsylvania.
There you go.
Back into doing what I was doing and did it for 17 years. But, you know, with anything, things change, you know, the community leadership changed, and it just became something after 17 years, you know, became something that, you know, just wasn't fun for me anymore. So,
You're in your 50s, you could retire.
Yeah, but
you could flip everyone the finger.
Yeah, I can. but you know, it's just not. All the kids are out of the house. Like I said, my last two are in college now. You know, I'm enjoying that stage in the life where, you know, the wife and I have the house to ourselves most of the time. It's looking at the next thing. My son was just married last year, so, you know, hopefully grandkids down the road, and you know, just looking at the next step. You know, I was down in I lived in Washington, D.C., and this is something you find. Every guy talks about, oh, I wish I was single again. You know, how great would it be to be on my own? Well, I ended up taking a contract down in Washington, D.C. last year, and my wife works for a school district up here. You know, she's a personal trainer for one of the gyms up here. It wasn't like we were going to move down there.
Right.
But with my son getting married, two daughters in college, you know, you still have to work at this point. So, and it was something I really couldn't say no to. So I went down and I got an apartment in the Annapolis area and lived down and worked in DC under this contract for the last year and was on my own. Basically, my wife came down once or twice on the weekends. I came up for a weekend here and there.
So she's here, your kids are in college or doing things and you go get a job. It's 5 hours away. Am I following you right here? Get out of here.
And it was just like a stepping stone. Hey, if it's something that we really like, you know, we can get a place down there. She can easily find a job down there.
so it wasn't
it just wasn't all it was meant up to be. You get home from work and then you're fixing your own dinner. You're doing all your own stuff. You're doing your own chores. I didn't really have much time out or to do anything other than work, eat and sleep. So, you know, it got old very quick and it's just not where I wanted to be in that stage in life, but it served its purpose. You know, it paid for the rest of my daughter's college. You know, it helped us out. My son ended up getting married in Annapolis. So it was great that we had a place there where he got married because everybody came from out of town. You know, her family was from the Mississippi area. You know, he went to school in Annapolis. So, you know, all his friends came in and then our family came down.
Let this be a lesson to anyone out there listening who wants a break from their marriage, because I am going through the same thing. Now, I'm married 30 years. You're married 28 years. So my mother-in-law has a place in Florida. My wife works remotely. So last winter, she says to me, my wife, who works remotely, she goes, you know what? I'm going to go down and live with my mother for a week or two throughout this winter. Now, my kids are all in college or away. And she said, you know what? I'm going to go live with my mother at her condo for a few weeks during January and February. And deep down inside, I'm thinking, ooh, this is going to be great. Yeah, I'm a bachelor again. I'm home all by myself. And like you said, every guy feels that way, right? So then she leaves the first few days. This is pretty cool. First week, this is pretty cool. And then I get pizza Friday. I bring it home. Hey, everyone, I brought pizza home, but there's only me. Nothing's fun anymore when you're by yourself. And then by the second week and third week, I'm like, I can't do this. So she would come back. But yeah, even a marriage that's, and I don't mean this in a negative way, old and tired. I love my wife. You love your wife. We have a great relationship. And you think, oh, you're just sick of each other. Have them go away for a week or two. You'll appreciate them, right? It doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gets old quick. It gets old really quick.
Yeah, it's a nice punchline. It's a nice joke. It's not nice to brag about it with the guys. But when it really happens, like you said, after a week or two, it's like, yeah, this isn't where I want to be in life right
now. This isn't where I want to be in life. So, yeah, we rearranged it this year. So my wife is only going to be gone for a week or so a couple times because I told her I can't handle this. I can't be home alone. It's pathetic in a way. You know, you sit in bed with your dog and watch TV. That's not good. He eats the crust of the pizza. Come on, there's more to life.
Yeah. And you find yourself talking to the dog more than more than you should be.
I was eating over the sink, Rob, because I didn't want to use any dishes. Eating over the sink. That's how pathetic my life became.
Yeah, I know. I get it completely.
It's like, why put a plate out? It's just me. All right. So you're doing all right in life now. You're doing some coaching. You got you're settled in. You're back here, and your health seems to be fine. You're everything's good in life.
Yeah, no more coaching now. You know, I coached the youth football up here, and then you know all my kids were through sports, just you know basically on the sidelines through their high school sports. But you know, I coached their youth football before he got into the high school football. But you know, it was that part in life. You know, where kids are doing youth sports, and you get involved, and you do the dad thing and the parent thing. You know, my daughters did tried their thing. Soccer, youth softball, and all that.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, I'd like to end on two things, and this is going to be fun things. Number one, your wife is the personal trainer to others, including Mindy Ramsey, my colleague at WNEP. Give me some dirt on her. Come on, give me some dirt, courtesy of your wife. Give me some dirt on Mindy.
You know, my wife doesn't talk shop with me. She tries to get me to go to the gym as much as she can, and that. Just not my thing to go around in a circuit and sweat with other people. So
me neither. So you're not going to give me any dirt on Mindy Ramsey.
I don't have any. You know, she's a regular. I know the WNEP was just at the gym. You know, one of the mornings last week they were at the gym and Mindy was anchoring and she was getting beat up for not being at the gym and I felt bad because the news girl that was there was like. Hey, Mindy, they're saying they haven't seen you a while. And as per my wife, I know she's there all the time. So you know, she was really getting beat up for not being at the gym when she's actually at the gym. And I felt bad for Mindy because I know how not going to the gym feels. My wife gives me a hard time all the time.
Well, I meant to ask you, too, before I have my second request. When you came here in 2004, did you immediately find WNEP or did it take a while to browse around a couple stations? What made you settle on us?
No, it was the main station for this area. You know, they had the most in depth. It's good to see the people that started here. You know, the weather people and some of the anchors where they've moved on now. Actually, I was down in D.C. and who's down there? The sportscasters down there now.
Pingalore,
Charlotte McBride.
Oh, Charlotte McBride. Yeah, Pingalore's in Florida. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
She's down in the D.C. area, and then there was the weather girl with the dark hair. I forget.
He's in Philly.
One of them went to the Weather Channel. One went to Philly.
Yep.
But it was nice to see that changeover and to see you in the morning and everything that goes on in the morning in the backyard.
You have a good time.
Actually, I'll give you.
I better be your favorite weatherman.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you some WNEP trivia that I'm related to. I won the Outdoor Life UTV back in 2008.
I bet you that sucker's outdated now, huh?
It's still in my garage.
Still going, okay. Yeah. Don Jacobs presented it to you, or who delivered that to you?
Who was the other guy with Don? Don wasn't there that day. It was
Don Jacobs.
His partner.
Yeah, okay. I can't remember who that would have been back then. But, So
they actually featured my son because he actually shot his first buck the day before we went to pick up the UTV on the air.
Excellent. I love it. All right. So here's my last request, Rob. And then we're going to end this thing. Are you ready? Let's pretend we're back in the day. It's in the 90s, early 2000s, whatever. I did something illegal. This is it. Give me my Miranda rights. Let's see it right from memory. There we go.
Oh, come on.
You can't do it. Come on. I want them all. You can't really from all the TV shows. I can almost do it.
Yeah, actually, you know what it is? You never had to depend on it because you always had to read it off the card and have them sign the card. Because people would just leave, you'd leave out one word. You'd leave out an and or you'd leave out something simple and they'd say the Miranda's no good because you didn't read it properly. So we got so used to reading it off the piece of paper and had them sign it that they were given their Miranda. You really never had. It's like having, you know, do you know your kids' cell phone numbers? No, you press the button on your cell phone.
No, yeah, you're right. So that's a good point because I would often watch movies or hear other police officers, and they, especially on PD Live shows like that, and they take out the card, and I'm like, they don't have that memorized, but you're right. They can't screw up even a one syllable or yep. the lawyers are going to be on them. See the things we learn here.
Yeah. So it's not all movies and TV. There's a reason behind it. But because of that, you know, in the laziness of the human brain, you never have to memorize it because you're always reading it. It's just like having I couldn't even tell you my wife's cell phone number. You know, I press the button that says wife.
Well, yeah, the brain prioritizes what it needs to know. And then it puts everything else in the back seats for a while. It makes total sense when you think about it. All right. Well,
sorry I couldn't end on a high note.
Well, you didn't know that this is a high note. Do you think I have a police record or no? A guy like me.
You know, they could probably get you for traffic violations on that bike, I'm sure.
The funny part is that here's a good ending for this. I was going through downtown German. This was like 3 years ago. And I'm a cyclist on a bike going through these small towns where there are no cars and stop sign after stop sign. So what I normally do is slow up, look, and keep going. I don't stop at stop signs when I'm on my bike training, doing a 30, 40 mile bike ride. Wouldn't you know, 3-4 years ago, I got pulled over by the police for going through a stop sign on my bike. I'm like, sir, you gotta be kidding me. He's like, your bicycle must follow the same motor vehicle laws as everyone else. You must stop at stop signs. And that was a pretty funny moment. Would you arrest a guy like me for going through a stop sign or at least pull me over? I mean, come on, let the little things go, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, you're talking German Pennsylvania. How much do they really have? It's actually, they deal with more than they should be for a small. Yes. They actually deal with more than they should be in a small town like that. But unfortunately.
But
something like that, you know, there's other things to find out there than that. But it's amazing that I came up with that as your crime, right?
That's funny because you are correct. The only thing you can lose respect from me if you want. The only thing I've done illegal in my entire life is I have numerous speeding tickets, but I've changed my ways. And being a man from my generation, in 1981, I think I was in 9th or 10th grade, and one of my buddies was down at Hess Department Store in Dixon City. It's a mall, and that was a store. And you remember the band Asia?
Yes.
Asia. So I was down there with a bunch of buddies. We're 15, 16 years old. You're at that age. He tries to shoplift the Asia album and put it in a bag that he had, and he couldn't get it in the bag. So
the big vinyl album.
The big album. He was trying to stuff in the bag and shoplift the album because he didn't have $10 on him. And then I grabbed the bag and I readjusted. And I go, just put it in there, and boom. And I shoved it in there, and we both walked out. And guess what happened? We got caught. So I was arrested when I was 15, 16 years old for helping him shoplift an Asia album from the store Hess's.
Did they just bring you home and let your parents handle it?
Yeah, it was a call the parents thing. That's all it was. Yeah.
That was the worst. You know what? That was the best and worst. You know, worst when it was you back then having it happen to you, but it stays with you. You know, I think my theft was a rubber handball from a local drugstore. brought me home, and you never do that again.
No, never. But if you were to go back to your computers in system in your police department, would you be able to find my record of stealing a Asia album in 1981 or two? Or no, that's probably gone by now.
No, it was a juvenile record, so it would have been sealed. And since they never really did it officially and just took you home to your parents, it wouldn't be on record.
Oh, perfect. Because I want that thing forgotten, even though I'm bringing it up in a podcast.
We can expunge it, right? After this. Do I have the authority to expunge your 15-year-old misdeed?
Yeah. All right. I learned from that. And Asia was a great band, by the way. Well, Rob O'Donnell, it was a great talking to you. Is there anything we left out that you want to shove in before we say goodbye? I think a lot of people can be inspired and touched and learned a lot about your profession and your career through your life arc and story. It's awesome.
Law enforcement today is, and first responders in general, so your emergency medical, your fire, and your first responders are really going through a rough time lately, you know, with all the targeting of them as a profession. Just when you see them, thank them. And when you see them, when you walk by them, you know, tell them you appreciate them, because they are the ones that are coming coming to run to your aid when you need help. And you know, we see one of the big thing with this Damaris Hamlin, who went down from the Buffalo Bills, and they showed the ambulance out on the field, and they said the lowest paid person, the EMTs that were there on the field, performed the best job on the field.
What a great point. You think of all the money that the players make and the coaches and everyone on that field. And then, yeah, and what changed the life there was not one of the million-dollar players, but you're right. Some EMT making $38,000 a year, perhaps, right?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just if you're out there, out and about, and you see these, most of them volunteer EMS workers on the ambulances, your volunteer fire crews, or your local police, you know, just say thank you and you know, give them the pat on the back that they deserve, because they will run into fire and they will run into gunfire to save you.
And I'm going to say it to you, thank you.
Just in the right place at the wrong time most of the time. That's my motto.
Yeah, but you did the right thing. I appreciate it. And thanks for the interview. People sometimes overlook your profession, but hopefully this helped a little bit.
No, I appreciate it, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Thanks, Rob.
Curiosity. What are you so curious about?
Everything.
Mr. Curiosity.